Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Kaiju Carnage. I am your host, Cal the Kaiju Guy, and today is my 100th episode that I've ever done, not counting the other podcast. Never thought that I would see this day whenever I started this thing. Honestly, didn't think I was going to last this long. And for the 100th episode, I'm going to be announcing the winner of the 100th episode contest that I did. And I have two guests that are joining me. One of them is already fidgeting with things around him and making noise. Stop. You know, I remember last time with the dog.
I'm sorry.
When under your breath, you're sitting there, good girl, that's a good girl.
I'm sorry. I didn't think it was going to actually make noise.
Oh, wow, okay. So, everybody, if you recognize that individual, that is Kid Kong.
How you doing?
My easily distracted friend.
Yeah.
And joining me for the second time, he's not been on the show in a good while since we talked about Godzilla versus Megalon, because we both have a mutual love and respect for that bad movie. But here he is, returning once again, my friend, and also the performer, writer, and composer of my new theme song, Ian.
Hello, everyone.
All right, so today we're going to be talking about King Kong. We're just going to be having a discussion about the original film. We just watched it. I'm going to get into all that in just a minute. But guys, yeah, I'm not going to lie. I'm going to toot my own horn right now real quick. 100 freaking episodes.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's
amazing.
It is outstanding.
Yeah, I mean, you know, whenever I started the podcast, I never thought that it was going to go this far. And that I would have as much fun with it and all that. He's already whispering to a dog. Look at him.
I'm doing it alone. They can't hear that. They wouldn't have even known if you hadn't ratted me out.
Just to let everybody know, we have numerous animals walking all around me. A cat and two dogs, and there's three other dogs that's locked up in a kennel right now because it's hot outside.
The two dogs that are running around are actually the parents of my dog.
Yes.
Not that any of y'all knew that.
No, yeah, they didn't, and I don't see why that was necessary to let them know.
Yeah.
But because I've told you guys before that Chris is married to my cousin. I claim her. I don't claim him.
Yeah. Wow.
And by marriage, I claim his daughter. But
yeah,
yeah. I'm kin to her. What about him? No, not him. But yep, 100 episodes. I'm blown away by it. I mean, naturally, I got to this landmark a lot faster than I initially thought I would, because now I do 2 episodes a week.
Yeah.
And there's been a few times that I've done 3 episodes a week. But, you know, so yeah, that's pretty cool. So, all right, King Kong, the original, 1933. We just got done watching it. This was the first time that you guys, either of you, had seen it, and both of you say in about 20 years or so?
Yeah.
Yeah? Ian was...
Him closer to 30, but yeah.
Okay,
Go ahead, laugh it up.
Okay, gonna go ahead and throw this out there. Chris and I are closer in age. I am soon to be 35, and Chris is 33. Ian is 41? 42.
He just turned 42.
And we treat him like he's an old man, even though he's not that much older than we are. But Chris pretty much does it way more than I do. I'll throw a joke out every now and then. But yeah, Chris is pretty relentless with it at times.
I'm giving him time off here and there.
I think you guys trade up every now and then.
Well, I mean, you know, we've talked before to where, like, he primarily does the age jokes, but he doesn't touch the hair jokes.
No, I'll leave that alone.
I've got no qualms about cracking hair jokes.
Some things are sacred. I won't mess with this.
So, yeah,
I was actually going to be nice and say, like, you know, congratulations on 100 episodes. Like, it's not just that you've made it 100 episodes. It's that, okay, anybody can make it 100 episodes. Not just anybody builds and develops a listener base that communicates with them and that the communication is reciprocal.
Like, he gets daily feedback.
Yeah, and you've done that, and I'm very proud of you for
Absolutely.
I appreciate it. But yeah, that's one thing that I love most about doing the podcast and all of that is being able to interact with the listeners and all that, getting the messages. I got a message last night. I can't remember if it was on Kaiju Carnage or on Godzilla Ultima, but from a kid, because I've talked about before that it's nuts to me that I'm as popular with children as I am.
Hey, big deal. Like,
it makes sense.
And that's part of the reason why, you know, and I've talked about this before to where, you know, I'm like, I try to run a clean show. No cussing, no dirty talking, yeah. And all that, which anybody that knows me in my personal life.
It's quite an accomplishment.
No.
That's the difference of Bob Saget on Full House from Bob Saget any and everywhere else.
Yeah.
This would be like discovering that Barney the Dinosaur moonlights as George Carlin.
Wow. But yeah, so it's a quite a feat that I can count on one hand how many times I've said curse words on the show, and a lot of times it's something like I mentioned Hell in a Cell, mm-hmm. like on my last episode, and I called a movie being in development hell, and I wouldn't necessarily consider that a cuss. No, I mean I really don't, but I mean that's as far as I've ever gotten with it. And again, anyone that knows me in my personal life knows that like that's not how I am.
He deserves a medal.
Yeah.
But yeah, so anywho, back to King Kong. So Ian, Chris, it had been a while since either of you had seen the film, since y'all were kids, by your own admission. So what'd y'all think after being so many years of watching it and all that? Like, what'd y'all think about it?
I actually really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was very good, start to finish. They did a great job with music, amplifying certain things, because, of course, back then they didn't have the same kind of technological advances we have as far as computer-generated imagery or anything like that. So the music was really used to add depth to what you're watching. Like, there's a scene where the chief of the tribal people is walking down the steps, and every step he takes, you hear a beat, and when he slows his steps, the music slows with it.
Yeah, and in a way that, to me, that's kind of lost these days, unless you're maybe listening to like a John Williams score. John Williams had a penchant for that, for being on the beat and very on the nose. But to me, the last bastion of that kind of scoring would be cartoons.
Yeah, yeah, I'll agree to that. Cartoons were pretty good about mixing music with action and all of that. I talked about Chris. I talked about on the original episode that, like, as far as like the music was concerned and all of that, that it changed the game with how scores were done in films. Like, this was the first movie that assigned individual characters their own theme, their own music,
right, yeah.
and all that kind of stuff. And doing things like, you know, the chief walking, and there's a beat with every step that he takes. And whenever Kong is first making his first appearance, and you hear like the same thing, like that dun, dun, like that was supposed to represent his steps that he was taking, getting closer to Anne and all of that. So yeah, the music was it was definitely a game changer in the grand scheme of things, and pretty much the way films are scored now, they owe it to this movie. That's the one that pretty much started that trend. And a lot of times, like, there would be scores that they would do for films, but it wouldn't be a lot of music going on, like, as some of the action was happening or while dialogue was happening or something like that. It was just like they would mostly use the music when they were going from, like, scene to scene.
Right, like incidental music or transition.
Yeah, something just to fill
transitional is a good way to
work. Yeah, just to fill the noise gap or something like that. But this one was the first one that had, like, at the time, whenever they made it, it had, like, the largest orchestra that had ever recorded any music for a film. And it, like, Marion C. Cooper was so determined because the studio, RKO, they just wanted him to use stock music.
Right.
And he refused. To the point to where he went on ahead and hired the composers, the orchestra, and all that, and paid them out of his own pocket. And basically made a deal with the studio to where, like, if it makes a certain amount of money, y'all will reimburse me for the orchestra and all that. And naturally, it made enough money to where he was reimbursed. But that's just how determined he was to have this type of score in the film.
Well, they made, like, $5.6 million, something like that.
I think it was, like, three, maybe. I'm not entirely sure.
Well, I mean, first of all, that's very forward-thinking on, what you said, it was Marion Cooper's part? Yeah. It's very forward-thinking on his part because 1933, this really isn't that far removed from silent films with just the, you know, I mean, there was a lot of stock music in that, or just almost like player piano style.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, yeah. I mean, because...
Vaudeville.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because only like maybe 11, 12 years prior to this film coming out, Willis O'Brien was the animator for The Lost World. Mm-hmm. That is a silent film. Mm-hmm. That is primarily just music and all of that. So, yeah, like to just in the grand scheme of things, only going forward about 11, 12 years and Cooper being to the point of like, I want a full orchestra. Each character has its own theme.
Yeah.
Like, you know, everything that he put into like with the music and all that. Very, very forward thinking by him. So, I don't necessarily have any questions as to like, okay, we can talk about this. Prior to us watching the movie, whenever I hit play, naturally there was the overture.
Yeah.
And we sat there just making small conversation while that was going on. And I stated that, naturally, King Kong is my favorite part of the movie. Like, yeah, that's everybody's favorite part of the movie. But other than Kong, as far as the human actors go, I said that Robert Armstrong, who plays Denham, yes, in the film,
yeah,
he was the highlight of the film to me. And my favorite human character of the film. So what did you guys think about Robert Armstrong? Do y'all agree that he was probably the best that there was?
I agree he was. The guy that played Driscoll, he seemed like he was more playing a caricature than an actual character. Right. Yeah. And a lot of the things that he would do and say. Whereas Denham seemed to, as the movie would go, it wasn't like he didn't act the exact same way in the first scene as he did midway through the movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, his acting seemed much more naturalistic rather than the kind of caricaturized overacting that was prevalent for films of that time.
More reactionary than it would be just as it is.
Right.
Yeah, well, you know, he did kind of, I wouldn't necessarily say it was character development, but yeah, he did progress more than the other characters did. As the film would go on. But yeah, pretty much virtually everybody else played that very stereotypical male character that was found in the movies back then. You know, they all kind of talk like this, you know? Yeah, like, yeah. And like everything, like even as far as like the way that they would move and the way that they would pose themselves, mm-hmm, and all that kind of stuff, it was just like, you could tell that whoever taught acting for Hollywood back then, like everybody used that same guy. Well, something.
Now, okay, this may also go back to, okay, we were talking about, you know, the development of music being used in a different way. In the grand scheme of things, movies were not that old. So acting was probably a lot more rooted in stage and theater than screen acting, in which
you had to overact in order for the sake of the audience.
Exactly. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I can see that.
Now, I think Faye Ray deserves some commendation. I mean, arguably the original Scream Queen.
She is the original Scream Queen, as far as I'm concerned.
And, you know, for this being probably her only role of note, I thought she did a fantastic job.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because I think it was you, while we were watching the movie, you asked, did she do anything else that was like major or big or anything like that? And I was just like, I don't think so. And I was like, she didn't need to.
Yeah.
Like this pretty much.
She's pretty set after this, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty much made her. And you made a comment about her being compared to Naomi Watts, or vice versa, Naomi Watts being compared to her.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, I felt that part of the reason Naomi Watts was picked for the Peter Jackson remake had not only to do with Naomi Watts's, you know, acting chops in her own right, but also the fact that, to me, she could bear more than a passing resemblance to Faye Ray.
More than a passing resemblance. Yeah, they're very, very similar looking. And whenever he made that comparison, I said they're both hot.
Yeah. Like, that's a toned down way.
Yeah. That's not what I actually said, but yeah, they're both very appealing to look at, but yeah, Faye Ray is, you know, I'll always tell anybody she's fantastic in the movie. The way that she acts, the way that, you know, it always gets me when she's tied up. And, you know, when Kong is coming to get her and she's doing all, like, flopping her head back and forth and all that stuff. Like, she just, a lot of people would look at it now, certain individuals, mutual people that we know that will remain nameless that would watch a movie like that and would walk away just kind of being like, I didn't care for it. I didn't like the way that they were acting. I didn't care for the score, or I thought it was stupid, or I thought this, or I thought that, and all that kind of stuff, because some people are just incapable of watching a movie like that, knowing the decade that it was made, the styles that were happening during that time, and all of that kind of stuff, and being like, this was basically the best that they had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whenever that kind of stuff was going on.
Suspending your disbelief does not simply apply to seeing what you're seeing in that moment. It applies to seeing what you're seeing and understanding what point in time it was made.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, because I've talked with Emily a few times, and... But I've talked with Emily a few times, and I've shown her some clips, lots and lots of clips of stop motion animation, different thing, you know, like King Kong, a lot of works from Harryhausen,
yeah.
A lot of works from Willis O'Brien and all of that. And I've beaten that dead horse like there's no tomorrow whenever it comes to as far as Emily is concerned, because I just stop motion. Because to me, it's crazy that somebody, that they were able to do that kind of thing and make it look as realistic as it was. Like, it's just...
I mean, that's extremely painstaking.
Yes!
Yeah.
Like, because, like...
How long did you say it took them to do the fight between Kong and the Rex?
It took, I think it was seven, I think it was 7 weeks.
Yeah. Lord.
Like, well, the film that I just did prior to this episode, recording this one,
Sinbad, right?
Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, like, it took Harryhausen 11 months to do all of the stop-motion effects in that film, and that's, like, anything dealing with the Cyclops, the dragon, the snake woman, the skeleton duel, the fight between the Cyclops and the dragon, like, you know, like, 11 months.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So, imagine that's your job.
Now, okay.
For a while, anyway.
Now, let's not forget, okay, if it took Harryhausen 11 months,
mm-hmm.
You know that movie didn't take 11 months to shoot.
No.
Which means, like, he had to have been hired, like, way out. You know?
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, like, a lot of times he was the one, because he was doing the stop-motion animation, like, you know, it's coincidental that we're talking about Harryhausen right now, because I am doing Harryhausen theme for my podcast, but he would, in a lot of times, he would have more control than the director would.
He'd almost need to.
Because yeah. The director would be like, well, I want to do this and I want to do that, and Harryhausen had the power to be like, no, that's a bad angle, because I need to be at this angle for the stop motion stuff that I'm going to be doing, and I need the actors to react this way and that way, and what you're wanting to do is not going to make that happen. And so the studios would look at the director and be like, listen to him.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a lot of times in movie making business that an animator had more say so than a director in a film, but Harryhausen did.
That man had such an impact that I believe I've talked to you about it before. He got to go on set for Corpse Bride when they made that,
mm-hmm.
and they treated it like it was this royalty coming to the set. They actually put the piano that you see them playing has Harryhausen stamped on the side of it because of him, because of the impact that he had on stop motion as a genre.
I mean, he's the king. His name is synonymous with stop motion.
Yeah, and you know, like I'm doing Harryhausen month this month for June. But I have mentioned that I'm going to be doing a Willis O'Brien month as well. And I've picked out a few movies that I'm going to do for him and do like a career spotlight for him and all of that. Because while I do find Harryhausen was the better animator, like we've heard people talk about, and I think I've used this quote before from a interview that I saw, that if Harryhausen is considered the grandfather of special effects, Willis O'Brien is absolutely the great-grandfather
yeah.
of special effects, because it was Harryhausen seeing King Kong for the first time and being like, that's amazing that they were able to do that with the stop motion and all that, that ultimately led him to want to be in filmmaking, that caused him to go and meet Willis O'Brien, and then Willis O'Brien started training him.
Yeah.
And then Harryhausen just took off, and, you know, Willis O'Brien was going through a lot of personal issues, like marriage issues. His children were murdered. And jeez. Yeah, so by his ex-wife. And so, you know, he was going through a lot of stuff. He had some ideas stolen from him and all that. He had a lot of personal turmoil that was going on. So it doesn't surprise me that his work never really progressed more than what it did.
Yeah.
But Harryhausen, you know, he was this very gung-ho, young, trying to impress anybody and everybody. Let's do it. And that's what he did. So anyone who's a Ray Harryhausen fan or just a fan in general of special effects and liking how they were done or in the art of stop motion, like King Kong is pretty much what really, really kickstarted making people want to get into filmmaking to say, like, I want to do something like that.
Yeah.
So, all right, Robert Armstrong, definitely the highlight of the film. We all, you know, unanimously like Faye Ray. She's perfect in every way. I think it's safe to, you know, safe to say that. You know, let's talk about, I got two things that I want to talk about. The first one I'll mention is, let's talk about how this film, this goes for both things that I want to talk about. It is a product of its time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, there are some racist things that can be found in the film that if somebody put something like this in a movie today, if it wasn't like a parody or something like that, like it would get...
Even then.
It would get crucified.
I guarantee you they could not make Tropic Thunder today.
Oh, no, it's only been 14 years. Yeah, probably not. I'm surprised they got away with Tropic Thunder when they did,
yeah.
To be honest with you. But, yeah, there's some racist things that are found in the film. But also, one of the things, and I think this stands out more than anything, is that the science of dinosaurs.
Yeah.
They were just...
Or the lack of them.
The lack of the science of dinosaurs for this film. Like, they were just very much... I think I stated in there that while we were watching the film, a lot of the dinosaurs that were in the film, they had only been discovered for like maybe 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
And it's like they just up and decided, like, ah, that one looks cool. We'll throw it in there, you know?
Yeah,
like,
pretty much.
Like you have a brontosaurus swimming, being completely submerged underwater. I'm not saying that they couldn't, but it's very unlikely that they could.
Yeah, it's going and, like this.
Yeah, like, going like now. That. Then it comes out. It has sharp teeth. It's chasing the guys and, like, freaking eating them and all that kind of stuff. And it's just like, wow, y'all literally just found a giant skeleton in the dirt and was like, yep, that's our monster. That's going to be in the movie. And, you know, there's the deleted scene. Yes. With the the spider pit scene that ended up getting cut, there's a triceratops that chases the guys and eats one. And the let's just talk about the sound effects, like the scream effects.
Oh my goodness!
That was in that film. Like, especially
every time we hear a particularly funny scream, we would imitate it.
Like
now okay. To be fair. I think dignity goes out the window when...
Upon death?
Well, if you're facing certain death from a monstrous creature, dignity goes out the window.
I mean, yeah, I'll agree to that, but, like, to me, the scream that stands out is homeboy that was falling off of the log. He was the last one standing, or hanging, really. And as he's falling, he does, like, a really long scream. And then, yeah, when just before he hits the bottom, he's like... Thud. But yeah, there's a lost scene. I've got the Blu-ray to this film, and I've had it for a while, and I just never bothered watching this particular scene. So while we were there, we were looking at the special effects. I mean, the special features. I saw it said lost spider pit scene, and I was like, okay, I'll watch this. Let's check it out. And so the three of us watched that scene for the first time, and I said that I wish they would have left it in the film, but then Ian popped in and said he made a good point where he's like, he don't think audiences would have been able to handle that.
No, they wouldn't.
Back then.
Not in the 30s.
Like, just because the stuff that they were having King Kong and the dinosaurs doing was probably pushing things back then.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, to have the spider pit scene, having, like, you know, three guys making their last stand, being surrounded by like four or five different monsters, and they're just swinging for the fences and showing them get eaten and all that. Like,
well, imagine if The Exorcist would have came out in the '50s with the effects and the iconography that you see in that. That would have been way too much. It was almost too much when it came out in the '70s originally.
Oh yeah.
Now, okay, something else to consider is that we watched the spider pit scene on its own. We didn't watch it inserted into the so
it wasn't built up to at that point.
Well, yeah.
Well, also like it might have been cut just for the reason of flow.
Yeah, pacing, could have been.
That could be.
Well, the studio already wasn't very happy with the pacing and flow of the movie. One thing in particular that they wanted King Kong to show up earlier in the film because they felt that too much time had gone by without seeing Kong, and they felt that the audience was going to get bored. And Cooper was basically like,
man, they would not no. be able
they would
to
not have been okay with the 05.
Oh, yeah, no, got... no. Or Jaws. Or I mean, Jaws.
How long did it take Kong to show up in 05? Almost an hour, right?
It's a little over an hour, I believe.
Yeah. Like, well, to put that in perspective, that movie was an hour and 40 minutes.
Yeah.
So we're talking about over half the movie before the ape would have even showed
yeah,
up.
Yeah, like, I think I mentioned, like, while we were watching, like, right whenever King Kong is, they're getting ready to do the show and all that. And I was like, if we were watching the 05 version, they would just now be getting to Skull Island.
If that.
Because it's a very long film. Just the theatrical version is a very long film, let alone the extended edition with a spy, the you know, Triceratops and them building the raft, trying to cross the river. Whenever you watched it, did you see the extended edition or the theatrical edition?
I've seen the
theatrical
edition.
Okay, yeah.
I love it. That was my first time seeing it. I had not seen the theatrical edition. I just went straight in, extended. Loved it. Loved every second.
9 times out of 10, whenever they release a movie that has a extended edition. Hold on a second, ladies and gentlemen. Chris.
He wants attention.
He can get it quietly. So, anywho, anytime they release an extended edition of a film, that's 9 times out of 10 what I want to go see.
Agreed.
Like, whenever it comes to Lord of the Rings at this point in time,
I can't watch the originals.
I don't. I have no desire to watch the theatrical versions. Or same thing Alexander. With The Hobbit. Alexander.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I mean, I think I told you before, I don't even own the theatrical cut to it. I've got, like, the director's cut and the final cut, and that's it. Like, I prefer, like, you know, because to me, I'm like, if there's an extended edition to the movie, I'm like, that's the edition that the director originally wanted people to see. And then for
like
whatever reasons, oh, let me cut this or let me cut that, studio interference and all that. Kingdom of Heaven, you know, I talked about that. There's a theatrical version of that and the director's cut, which has like an additional hour or something like that of footage. Which I think is far superior to
Kingdom of Heaven, you're talking about?
Yeah. It's far superior to the theatrical version. And so, yeah, whenever I went to let Emily watch
the
05 King Kong for the first time, I was like, she already has a hard time watching long movies. And I was like, boy, you're going to hate me. You know, because I've got a doozy for you to watch. And it was the extended edition to Peter Jackson's King Kong. And it almost broke her. I'm not going to lie. It came very close because, you know, in her opinion, it was just like there were parts of it that just drug on too long. And I'll agree with her. Like, I mean, I like extended editions more, but I've got no problem admitting that there are parts in Peter Jackson's King Kong to where I'm like,
they're superfluous.
They could have wrapped that up a little bit faster. Yeah. Or I can see why they cut that out for the theatrical scene. Yeah. But probably, and Emily had stated that this was her biggest problem with the King Kong, the Peter Jackson's King Kong, was Jackson's style can be a little bit outlandish at times. And I know I've talked about this on the podcast before, but the main thing I'll always go back to is like the Brontosaurus stampede scene. To where like, you literally have 50 of them running down this very, very, very small
narrow
canyon
with a sudden curve.
And all of the main characters. There were a few like little side characters, you know,
red shirts.
Yeah, red shirts.
Perfect way to put it.
They were there, but none of the main characters touched, kicked anything. They're just running with literally like 400 pairs of legs, you know, just going, and nothing. You never felt that they were in any sense of danger or anything like that. And it kind of takes me out whenever I watch that part.
Meanwhile, I believe most of the party that was going after Anne in the original, most of them didn't make it back.
Yeah. The ones that were initially going after her, like, none of them really made it back.
Yeah.
Like, Carl made it back because whenever the raft scene happened, like, the raft got tumped over, and Carl ends up, like, going back on his own because he got separated. And then the rest of them, while they were running, that's whenever Kong shows up and tumps them off into the spider pit scene, and all that's left is Jack. So, yeah, they didn't make it back.
Well, okay. You were saying about Peter Jackson's style. To me, Peter Jackson is a shining example of a filmmaker who he doesn't know how to make things for the small screen.
True. I'll give him that. I'll give him that. But, yeah, like, it's not just in King Kong. There's a few moments in a good deal amount of his films to where, like, things will be, like, at a certain tone, a certain pace or something, and it's like something just gets thrown in there. And I'm like, why? Like, one thing in particular I'll mention, Lord of the Rings, Two Towers. Battle of Helm's Deep is going on. It's a very, very serious moment. We all know what's hanging in the balance at Helm's Deep and all that kind of stuff. And then out of nowhere, here comes Legolas. He throws a shield downstairs and he surfs down a staircase while shooting his arrows, like, and all that. And just, when I see stuff like that, I'm just like, it completely changes the mood for me.
That's the Middle Earth equivalent of John Woo Gun Fu.
No, Legolas went from being yes, he was a skilled elf archer in the books, but they essentially made him Spider-Man in these movies.
Yeah, like, ridiculously so. Like,
and there was no reason to put him in the Hobbit.
Like, Legolas was like the equivalent to a living, breathing superhero.
Yeah.
In Tolkien's universe for those films. But yeah, enough about Jackson and all that stuff.
Yes.
So, the other thing I wanted to talk about was some of the racist stuff, because there were a few lines of dialogue to where, like, they would say something, and I had seen the film more recently, but because y'all hadn't seen it in a long time, y'all would look at me and be like, what did he just say? You know, and I'm like, yeah, you heard that correctly.
I mean, okay. Yes, it's a product of its time. I don't feel that anything within the film merits any sort of...
cancel culture?
Yes.
No, absolutely not.
No.
The second they try to come to cancel the original King Kong, we've truly lost as a society.
I mean, I think we're pretty close to losing as a society as it is right now.
I mean, there are some bastions that they can't quite get through.
Well, the thing is, okay, I don't feel that anything in the movie was mean-spirited.
No.
More than anything else, it was, at best, ignorance.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not going to repeat any of the lines that were stated and all of that kind of stuff. But yeah, there were a few that whenever it would happen, you know, like, where it was like, God. And I think that's whenever I made the first comment where I was like, you can tell this movie is a product of its time.
Oh, absolutely.
To where, like, they could just throw stuff like that out there. But, you know, I mean, things just didn't, they didn't think about that kind of stuff back then, you know. And I think it's largely what Ian said, ignorance. I saw a clip on Facebook the other day of a Looney Tunes cartoon, and it said something like, wow, man, we were wild back then. And it was a Western themed episode, and Bugs Bunny is a cowboy and he's defending a fort that's being attacked by Indians, and as he is shooting his gun, he would yank out a piece of chalk and go, one little, two little, three little Indians. and he did that, like, until he got to 10 of them. And I was just like, my God, like, you know, like, someone would get crucified if they tried to do that today. And before anybody wants to say anything, because I did repeat that little thing about Bugs Bunny killing the Indians and singing the song, my granny's full-blood Choctaw, so I'm okay with saying stuff about Native. But, so, yeah, let's talk about the stop motion. Willis O'Brien.
Fantastic.
I loved it. I thought it was especially good during at the climax with the Empire State Building, because after Kong gets shot, you know, before he falls, before he takes the final tumble, you can see in his face
that he's pained.
Yeah, he's pained. You see the fatigue.
Yes. Like, I'm more partial to the various times that you see him when he's fighting other large animals and he kills them. He then proceeds to play with parts of their mouths or like
the very simian behavior.
The plesiosaur that wrapped itself around him like a snake that he killed. Yeah, after he kills it, he grabs its head. He's like flopping its head. Like, how does that kind of work? Like, it's very, as you said during when we watched it, it's very simian. It's very believably ape-like. Acting.
Mm-hmm. Like, it was unbelievable how realistic he made Kong. Like, there's another quote in a, it's a documentary about kind of like the history of King Kong. That's about an hour long. It's called Long Live the King.
Yeah.
And somebody mentioned something about stop motion versus special effects today. And the person said, like, the ultimate difference between those is that you look at stop motion and you're like, you know it's fake, but it feels real.
No.
But you see the special effects they use today is like, it looks real,
but you know
it's fake.
I have more kind respect for stop motion, claymation, and things like that than I do for a lot of modern CG, because with the way that a lot of modern computer-generated imagery is done, the computer programs are so simplified a 14-year-old can do it. Whereas you see like different things like stop motion, claymation, where you see fight scenes and things like that, you can tell there was a lot of effort and a lot of time, a lot of thought put into that. Like, there's a lot of fatigue in that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, Harryhausen, you know, he stated in numerous interviews that he talks about, like, he was impressed by the technology that was used today and all that before he passed. But he would also kind of take it as, like, a point of pride where he would sit there and be like, to create one monster, he's like, one person does the head, one person does the tail, one person does this arm, one person does that arm. And then, like, he just kind of smiled, and he's like, whenever I was making movies, it was just me.
Yeah.
You know, like,
that's
so.
That's why I've always loved movies and TV shows like Wallace and Gromit, Chicken Run, The California Raisins, things like that, because you can tell that a lot of effort went into those.
Well also, okay, as an example for, you know, the contrast that we're talking about between vintage effects such as stop motion and modern, you know, usage of CGI, let's look at, you know, John Carpenter's The Thing versus the prequel / sequel that used CGI. The difference was, like, incredibly outstanding, because I'll take the practical effects.
Agreed.
From Carpenter's The Thing any day.
I'll wholeheartedly agree with that.
Well, because it goes back to that quote, like, whenever you see stop motion or practical effects or something like that, like, you know it's fake, but it feels real.
Yeah.
It's more creepy. It's more like you feel more emotionally attached to something like that because you know what's coming at somebody. Mm-hmm. Like, if it's an animatronic claw, you know that claw is real, whether it's controlled by a person or not. Whereas at the end of the day, with today's CGI, you know that some things were probably done with just simply, like, they had a stick. Like, react to this,
like,
stick.
Or a tenor. Not to go back towards Peter Jackson, but to go back towards, explain what we're talking about, the spider pit in the 05 King Kong. Like, yeah, there's some jumpy moments when they're in there and they're trying to climb up the walls and a claw will reach out and grab them and pull it in. But at the end of the day, like, yes, it looks real, but you know it's not.
Yeah.
Right. You know that is completely computer generated. You know they didn't actually have a gigantic animatronic claw rip out of the wall at 40 miles an hour to grab a person and yank them back in.
Well, for me personally, whenever I see practical effects versus CGI, I don't just see the practical effect.
Yeah.
I see the craft, the love, the heart.
That's why anytime I see anything that Tom Savini is attached to, I know it's going to be good.
Yeah, Tom Savini, Rick Baker,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Jim Henson before he passed.
Agreed.
Oh, Jim Henson was a freaking master. Mm-hmm. Wow. But, yeah, the stop motion was fantastic. The scenes where, you know, he would have Kong interacting with some of the people, he would also do stop motion for the people, like, you know.
Yeah, like use dolls and things like that.
Yeah, he would do that. And as you said, you could see, like, the emotion and stuff like that in Kong's face.
Yeah.
There was somebody else that was quoted by saying they don't know how Willis O'Brien did it, but somehow he gave that little doll a soul.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you see the emotions on his face, like the facial expressions. And also there's points where, whether it's when he's walking through the trees at the beginning to pick up man, or when he's climbing up the mountain, or not the mountain, I'm sorry, the Empire State Building, because of it being stop motion, them having to position different things and moving the fur down, it almost looks like the fur is moving as the animal is alive as it is moving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or maybe even wind.
Yes.
Yeah.
Blowing his fur and all of that kind of stuff. But yeah.
The blood flow at times, depending on what animal's getting injured.
Now, I told them whenever we were watching the film, so I'll go ahead and say that now. I remember there are certain scenes that stick out in my mind whenever I first saw King Kong. Like, that's just going to be, like, I remember my thoughts and how I felt whenever I first saw certain scenes. And one of them was just after he beats the meat eater and, you know, he goes on, Jack comes, there's a very close shot of the meat eater's mouth and you just see the blood like free flowing out of its mouth. That's always going to stick with me because I'm just like, that's freaking awesome.
Yeah.
Like, I thought I liked the way that it looked.
Yeah.
And other scenes, like my favorite shot in the film is whenever he's coming through the gate for the first time. Everybody turns to run and he just very slowly opens it up. And whenever he's initially climbing the Empire State Building and whenever he falls from the Empire State Building.
Yeah.
Like, those are the scenes that, like, even whenever I was a little kid, like, I remember what it was like first watching those scenes and thinking, like, this is the most amazing movie I've ever watched in my life at that point in time.
Yeah.
So, what about y'all?
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I've got a whole spiel. Okay.
Go ahead. Go right ahead, man.
Okay. I love this movie from start to finish. It's got to be probably one of the more epic monster movies of its time, or possibly the first epic monster movie.
Before in another episode, I called this film the Citizen Kane of monster movies.
No, that's a very apt description.
I believe Rotten Tomatoes has it listed as the number one horror movie of all time, or from its time period, or something like that. Like, it's considered a horror movie. I know that.
Yeah,
I know it is.
I don't agree with that, but it is.
Well, back then, it probably certainly was, but by today's standards, it's just like, okay, it's just a regular adventure film. But I'm sorry, Ian, go ahead.
As I said while we were watching it, it strikes me as a very early example of meta filmmaking. It's a movie about a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I don't know, man, just the overall scope and feel of it, I was blown away.
So, what was the question again?
What parts stand out?
What parts stand out? Okay. I've got different parts that stand out for different reasons for myself. To me, one of the first real standout moments, and this probably comes from my love of all things comedic, whether it's unintentional or intentional, when they are beginning to prepare their first sacrifice in the movie, and they are doing that whole ritual and everything, and all the people that have come off the ship are coming around the thing, and Denham's like, get the camera, I want to try and get a picture of this before they finish. And he gets the camera set up, and as he's about to get ready to film or to take the shot, the natives notice him, and the tribal chief says something, and they all stop and just stare. And he looks at him, and I believe he says,
it's like a full 2 second
thing. Yeah.
He goes, well, I think they spotted us.
he's like, hurry up before they spot us.
Yeah.
And then, like, they stop. He hollers. The whole tribe just, like, in unison looks their direction. And he goes, too late. They spotted us.
Yes. Exactly. And how they just kind of, they head back, even though the natives start coming towards them. Nothing happens, and they're able to go back to the ship. Which is a bit of a contrast to what happened in the Peter Jackson one, but that's neither here nor there. The next part that really stands out to me is, again, when Kong first shows up to take Anne, the first time you see him on screen, as he parts those trees and it closes up on his face, and you see the look on his face. Like, it's very, it's a visually striking moment compared to what we have seen up to that point. Because everything we have seen up to that point still very much stems in the world of realism, reality. And again, to go back to what you said, you know it's not real, but the fact that it's right there, it's like you can see it, you could reach out and touch it if you were there. It has more to it than it would be if it was just a computer-generated image.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up, the first shot we see of Kong, because that's why I was asking you about the trailer. I wanted to know, how much
the audience knew going in?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Because, like, if you knew nothing, you know, like, you know, somebody just mentioned this film, King Kong, you don't know what it's about. You go to the theater, and there's that first reveal. Like, I would love to read, like, reactions from viewers of the time.
Agreed.
First time.
Oh, I'm sure we could find them, you know, because we see all the time, you know, like, on Facebook or something like that. It'd be like, here's a review for somebody who first saw the Beatles, you know, or something like that. Like, these kids ain't going to last very long, you know, or something like that. I read one of somebody that reviewed Kiss, like one of their first concerts or something. And it was basically sitting there saying they just need to hang it up because they're not going to, like, there's no way that they're going to have any. They're not going to have any longevity or anything like that. And here they are now doing like an end of the world tour that's already made like over $100 million and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I would love to see. I might see if I can look up some original reviews and stuff like that.
And like contemporary reaction.
Yeah, because we had. There's a trailer attached in the Blu-ray that I've got, and it said, like, theatrical trailer. Well, then whenever we watched it, it was showing an awful lot of, like...
Everything.
Scenes in the movie, and we're like, why is it doing
see,
that? But
you
then
you would see Kong on the Empire State Building.
Towards the end, it said, like, see it this time.
Yeah.
And it was written on the screen, like...
Re-release.
The re-release.
Yeah.
And so we looked for an original trailer, and we can't find one.
Yeah. Well, that and also before it said re-release in that trailer, just the wording said, you know, Sea Kong still the eighth wonder of the world.
Yeah.
And that's why I was like, that's not original.
You think that might have came out around the time they were doing Son of Kong?
It may have, because I don't know exactly how much advertising they did for the movie back then. I know they did the whole novelization with Edgar Wallace so that they could try and pull those guys in. Like his fan base and all of that kind of stuff, which Edgar Wallace did end up getting a writing credit in the opening credits of
I
the
saw
film.
That.
So did I.
And I think it says like a story by Edgar Wallace and Marion C. Cooper. And so people kind of already knew what was going to happen if they had picked up the book, because the book was released in December of 1932, I believe, where the film came out in either March or May of 1933.
That's very, I'm sorry to cut you off. That's extremely similar to the original Star Wars movie. The novelization with pre-production artwork came out in 76. And then, of course, you know, Star Wars came out in 77. So.
Yeah, and, you know, it was because of that, like, after the films were made and all of that kind of stuff, the reason why people are able to do so many different things with Kong now, and that there's been unofficial sequels that are done and all of that kind of stuff is because the character and general story of Kong is in the public domain, because it was discovered in the 70s that because the novelization was released first, they didn't renew the copyright.
Yeah.
So he fell into the public domain.
Right.
And that's just, you know, that's just how it happened. But, so sorry about that. Something just happened in the background. I'm not going to give it any more time of day.
That's good.
But,
yes, let's move on.
Yeah. So, what were we talking about?
I had mentioned about Kong the first time we see him as something that visually stuck out to me.
Yeah. Like outstanding moments from the film.
Yeah. And I would just, you know. I'm going to see if I can find some original reviews or reactions and stuff like that, because you never know.
Yeah.
Like, that could have been terrifying for people back then. I sent you an audio clip.
You did.
Probably about a month ago, where someone had brought a tape recorder in.
Jaws, I believe.
For Jaws 2.
Yeah.
And
when the shark is coming towards
and they attached the audio to the actual scenes that the audio was at,
so that you could see how their reaction was.
And
it was outstanding.
People were screaming,
like,
in
get
the theater.
Away, no,
like, I mean, like, the girls were like, I mean, like, you would swear
full bore screaming.
You would swear they were in the water with the shark.
Okay.
Like
okay. Part of the reason I'm so curious about original reactions is because I've heard stories. One of my ex-girlfriends had a degree in film, so we talked about it all the time. And one of the things she brought up to me was original viewer reactions. If, you know, the first time they see it, they saw like a train coming towards them, straight towards them. You know, they, you know, the audience would freak out. Or if somebody pulls a gun and pulls the trigger and you hear the bang and see the puff of smoke. I mean, if you're not familiar with the medium of film, what would your reaction be?
Yeah,
because,
yeah, that's
true. I mean, now it could not be more everyday to us. We, you know, I'm pretty sure everyone here grew up with a TV, Saturday morning cartoons, blah, 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 you know. So, I mean, it's simply part of everyday life.
Well, yeah. I mean, back then, the only way to be able to see that kind of stuff was to actually go see it in a theater.
Yeah,
right. Right. So, I mean, if you've seen something that's completely mind-blowing and you can't imagine, you know, that taking place, what would your reaction be? I'm just very curious.
I mean, you know, I'm not entirely sure. You know, something in the vein of that got brought to my attention the other day is just like, what would a reaction be? Is the fact that George Washington, one of our founding fathers, first president of the United States, he died before any dinosaurs' remains were ever discovered.
Right.
So George Washington literally went his entire life having no idea that dinosaurs existed.
Yeah.
What would his reaction have been? You know, like, that would have been nuts.
Well, keep talking. I forgot a name. I'm gonna look it up.
But like, you know, like, but even think about ourselves. You talking about like it's such an everyday thing. Can you remember the first time you were ever exposed to the knowledge that dinosaurs exist? I can't. Like, it's just like...
I don't remember first being exposed to the knowledge, but I do remember being, like, 5 years old, reading books on it.
Well, I could remember, like, reading about certain dinosaurs for the first time, but, I mean, I can't remember a time in my life where it's like, I didn't know at least one dinosaur that existed.
Right.
Like, even to the point to where, like, I've talked about before that I first caught King Kong in a hotel room when I was about 5 years old. And whenever he went up against the T-Rex, even being five, I remember like, holy crap, he's about to fight a T-Rex, right, or something, you know? So even like 5 years old, I knew what they were. I can't remember whenever I first discovered that. So yeah, like I can imagine what it would be like for people in the 30s whenever they would go to a theater and see something like King Kong for the first time. Even if they were familiar enough with, okay, that type of special effect is, they call it stop motion or whatever like that. Like, you know, you kind of understand how it's done. Even just seeing the giant animatronic face for Kong, or the animatronic arm for Kong that, like, reaches out and grabs Anne and all of that kind of stuff. Like,
I mean, like, okay, this was somebody's first movie.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Everybody's got a first movie.
Yours was E.T.
Yeah, yeah. Either E.T. or Ghostbusters, whichever came out first.
E.T. came out in 82, Ghostbusters came out in 84.
Okay, then it was E.T. But yeah, I mean, this was somebody's first movie.
You're talking about first movie to see in theaters?
I'm talking about ever.
Ever?
Yeah.
Oh, I ain't got a clue what my first movie would be.
I know my first movie in theaters for the longest time, I believe it was The Lion King. Then come to find out from my grandmother, it was actually the Flintstones movie.
Which I was ecstatic about, because I'm all about the Lion King losing records for anybody, because the trash. But anywho.
Kimba the White Lion deserves better.
Much, much better. And that's as far as I'm going. But
what I was gonna mention about you talk about how Washington never got to experience dinosaur bones or anything like that. Lived his whole life with that. The only like similar thing I could have thought of, I could not for the life of me remember if he fought in the Revolutionary War or the Civil War. You're familiar with Angus McCaskill?
The name sounds familiar.
He was up for a long time. Guinness Book of World Records had him as the tallest non, like, hormonally caused giant and strongest man in history at 7'9". One of the feats of strength he accomplished when he was in the Civil War was a cannon, like the barrel of a cannon had fallen into the mud, and rather than leave it there for the Confederates to get, he picked it up out of the mud, put it on his shoulders, and walked with it.
Jeez.
And knowing that he was 7'9", I mean, you look at Shaquille O'Neal compared to a human being of normal stature, you know, if aliens land in like 100 years and they dig up his bones and they dig up your leg bones, they're going to think these are two different species. It's the same kind of thing. He would never have understood, like, how this has got to be something that's still living. This can't be something that's just dead. If it's that large, it has to be still alive.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. Even just thinking about that, you know, 7'9", picking up a cannon, just walking with it, part of me was like, I would need to see that to believe it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, there's a lot of eyewitness reports on that.
Yeah, but I'm not saying it's not real.
No, I'm not
it's
saying
it's just like,
you
it's hard for me to wrap my brain around yeah. it. That, like, then, there was a 7'9" dude in the Civil War that was just like, hey guys, you forgot your cannon. Like, you know, it's like.
He killed 11 Confederate soldiers, two of which were on horseback. One of the ones on horseback actually stabbed him, and he got angry, grabbed the horse by the neck, moved its head out of the way, and punched the man so hard that it caved in his breastbone.
Holy crap. Wow.
But that's what I'm saying is that, you know, if Washington had come across dinosaur bones, he would have naturally assumed this is something that's still living. He would not have been able to wrap his mind around it because he wouldn't have seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, So, we're going up on an hour long for this episode. Do we have anything else that we want to mention as far as like the movie is concerned or any other little comments or anything like that?
Well, I mean, not really, other than I noticed that he tended to pick people up upside down.
Yeah.
Kong, and
yeah.
He would drop them, and they would either land directly on their heads, or as he dropped them, they would mysteriously end up right side up.
I still say, you know, like, the one I feel most sorry for in the whole film is that one woman.
Yes.
You know, yeah. That one, because, like,
she
after...
was minding her own business.
She was up there, she was asleep, probably had just a pretty normal day, just like, yeah, whatever, it's time for bed. And then all of a sudden, this giant hand just reaches up in there, grabs her, and is just like, nope, you're not who I'm looking for, and then just drops her.
Like, to her death.
Okay. Yeah.
I do have one more thing to add. I know you're not a fan of The Simpsons. Have you ever seen the Treehouse of Horror where Homer is King Kong?
Of course not.
I actually advise you to watch that, because it's actually it's a shorter thing. It's only like 9 minutes. But it does a really good job of encapsulating what you see as far as the movie
it's
goes.
It's going to be an excruciating 9 minutes for
just
me.
Just ask Rob. Rob loves The Simpsons.
I don't care. He can love them all day long. All three of you can love them all day long. I don't like them. That's my problem.
It's not bad. That's all I'm going to say is that you would actually probably enjoy part of it.
I might. As much as I dislike The Simpsons, there are moments that cracked me up.
The boy.
Bring me the boy.
Yeah. That's all I got.
The thing that stood out for me, and it really jumped out at me watching it, there at the end, he's on the Empire State Building. The planes are coming. You know, they start shooting. The hopelessness of the situation. Because by this time, the viewer has become somewhat attached to Kong. You can't help but root for Kong. But you know, this is not going to end well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no way this can end well.
I mean, pretty much, yeah. I mean, at that point in time, everybody pretty much knows that, okay, this is a tragedy.
Yes.
Like, we've seen Kong go through so much. I think, I mean, I mentioned while we were watching it, I was like, this is pretty much, like, while on the island, like, that was pretty much the worst day in Kong's life.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Because he was just like, oh, I'm going to get my normal sacrifice that the natives usually give me.
Like, oh, wow,
look, like, oh, wow, look at this pretty girl, you know, I'll take her. Like, oh, God, why are these people chasing me? Ow, what are they throwing? These things are shooting at me. Dadgummit, now there's a T-Rex. Like, now here's a freaking snake. You know, like
a pterodactyl.
Like, where'd the girl go? That little punk down there's got her, you know? Like, it seemed like every time
wakes
he turned
in New York.
Every time he turned around, something bad was happening to him. But yeah, as far as like the hopelessness that Ian was talking about, like, you can, you know, like, it slowly begins to dawn on the audience, like, as he's nearing his end. Like, you've seen Kong, we just talked about his worst day that he's ever had and everything that he's went through, but he's been able to overcome everything that he's gone through. But then he gets to the top of the Empire State Building, and every time the planes pass by, it kind of seems like they're not really phasing him all that much. Like, right. He's swinging at them and all that kind of stuff. He's not really slowing down, but then we get a hint that, like, it is starting to get to him. whenever his torso is a little bloody. He touches the blood. He looks at his hand and all that. And then after that, like with each pass, he's getting slower and slower. Mm-hmm. And then to the point to where like he kind of slips and he's hanging on. The music starts and all that kind of stuff. It's like it's starting to click in the audience's head that like...
this is the end.
He's not going to make it out of this one.
Right. Like, and you know, that's whenever I said in there, that was the last time he reaches to touch Anne, and that's when I said he's saying goodbye.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like he picks her up, he kind of looks at her, and then he sets her back down, and like almost as if he was petting her.
Yeah.
Like he was saying goodbye, or even like, I just want to hold her one last time, or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and you know, then he falls.
That whole thing with him up there, that's a good metaphor for when you think everything is going well, even if you see things on the horizon that maybe that might be a problem. At the moment, things look fine. It's not until it starts happening that you realize you've got yourself into a situation where there is no escape for yourself.
Yeah. And
you can almost see in Kong's face when eventually he realizes that, even as he's swiping at the blades, because the last couple that go by, he doesn't even bother.
No, they just come by and he's just kind of like letting them come and he's just taking the shots because he doesn't have it in him anymore.
Yeah,
and you see the fatigue in his face mm-hmm. and in his eyes.
Yeah, but there was really no reason other than like Marion C. Cooper's original idea as to why Kong climbed the Empire State Building. Like, I believe it was in the 05 Kong, whenever, after he dies, like one of the reporters like he said something along the lines of like, why'd he climb up there? He should have known that he just cornered himself and he wasn't going to be able to escape. Like, the whole idea behind King Kong originated just because Cooper had a dream one night about a giant gorilla rampaging through New York, climbing the Empire State Building and dying.
Yeah.
So there's no other reason of like, oh, well, you know, they kind of tried to tie some reasons to it, like in the 70s remake that they did, to where, like, whenever he climbed the World Trade Center, to where it's like, well, it reminded him of his home. He went back, you know, like, to him, it was like, it was the same as his home and all of that. Like, no, there's no other reason other than Cooper.
He did that in the 05 as well.
He had the dream, and it was straight up just like, this is his demise. This is how he dies.
Yeah.
Like, there's no reason or rhyme behind it. He climbs the Empire State Building. That's where he's going to die. And in the movie, I believe I've told both of you this before. I know I've told the audience before. In the movie, he stays up there until he pretty much just can't hang on any longer. And he falls to his death.
Yeah.
In the novelization, which is in the public domain, he actually leaps to his death. Like, he's leaping at one of the planes, like trying to get it, to stop it or something like that. And because he took the leap, he fell to his death. And so that part of, you know, that part's in the public domain, which I've talked about before with the audience and with both of you, that I'm looking at doing a full rewrite of the original King Kong novelization, updating some of the science, maybe changing some of the dinosaurs around. Like, instead of a brontosaurus doing everything that it did, maybe
a mosasaurus.
Maybe, or a spinosaurus.
Or a spinosaurus.
Or something like that. Something that is a carnivore, but is aquatic, but can also come on land, and all of that kind of stuff. But I have put thought into, like, if I say that it's based on the 1932 novelization, I'm in the clear. But I can't do anything with, like, original stuff that was found in the movie. And one of the things would be having Kong fall to his death. Like, I would actually have to write him leaping from the,
right,
like, to get, like, maybe the last plane or something like that. Like, I'd be in the clear.
Yeah.
You know, like that. But yeah, that's pretty much how the original book ended. So,
well, never mind.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was gonna say, depending on the time place in which you have it, you know, transpire.
Yeah, who's to say you couldn't update the time period like
exactly?
You
helicopters can hover. They can jump after that.
Yeah, this is true. I'll talk more about all that stuff later on whenever I really fully delve into wanting to mess with all of that. Which,
once you commit,
I will full on start talking that. Thanks to my cousin Chris's wife, like, I have a avenue that I'm planning on utilizing for publishing some of my works and all of that. And I've been going through a lot of ideas of things that I can do, and I've been looking at a lot of public domain titles and things like that to pretty much put my own spin, my own twist on, like turn certain things into like a kaiju style universe that normally wouldn't be a kaiju style universe. I'll keep some of that stuff under wraps for right now. Ian has been told about some of them, but I'll keep the audience under.
I was about to say, I have not. So am I included in that?
I mean, I'll talk to you about it after we're done recording. But and talking about some mythological tales and stuff like that, you know, just like doing some short stories and stuff, like a collection of short stories and all that. But so that's what I'm looking at doing here most recently, just to kind of get back into the groove of writing and all of that, because I haven't done it in a very, very, very long time. And once I get my confidence back up and all that, then I'll be like, okay, now it's time to tackle my rewrite of King Kong. So I think that pretty much does it for our discussion on the movie and all of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do it. And
I don't think I got anything
any more
else to
comments. Have. Okay, guys. Well, you know, the whole point and purpose of me doing this episode, as you guys are aware, it's my 100th episode.
Yay!
And to thank my listeners, I was going to give you guys an opportunity to get something out of it. Just as a thank you to you guys, because I wouldn't be doing this without you guys that listen to the show on a weekly basis and send me messages and all of that kind of stuff. Like, I just wouldn't be doing it. And so the contest has been pretty much that you guys can follow me on all of my social medias. That was the initial rules to being in the contest. And then to win after I would choose a winner, which I already did choose a winner. I did a very old school, just wrote the entrance names. It was four of you. Wrote the entrance names on pieces of paper, put it in a bowl, mixed it up, and then pulled one out. And that's who won. So you each had a 25% chance of winning. But the grand winner of the contest was going to get a $50 Amazon gift card, a movie of your choosing for me to cover on the podcast, and as well, if you so chose to do, would be a guest on the podcast by downloading the Anchor app and utilizing the phone call feature and all of that, and you would have been a guest on the show. So I've already chosen the winner prior to doing the recording and you guys coming over and all of that, and so the winner of the 100th episode thing that I'm doing is my friend, Robert Delaloy. So congratulations, buddy, on winning. I had already talked to you because you're the one that sent me the message saying that you was kind of wary about joining because of stage fright and you didn't want to actually be a guest on the show, which I understood. And I said, well, if you win, you can just opt out of that. So if you still choose to opt out of it, congratulations. You're opted out. And if not, you'll be a guest on the show, but you're also going to get a $50 Amazon gift card, as well as you can choose any film, and I will cover it in the method that I cover, talking about like the production legacy and all of that kind of stuff. Any movie that you decide to do. Well, within reason. Don't give me any like adult films or something like that. Like, you know. But yeah, so congratulations, Robert. You were the winner of the 100th episode contest. So, do you either of you have anything else to add to this?
I was just going to say, you know, I'm really glad we did this today.
Yeah, same.
I mean, congratulations again to you and, you know, for the show and everything, making it this far. And I think you've got many times, you know, what you've done so far still ahead. I think the film holds up.
Oh, yeah.
It holds up. And, yeah, you know, like, I know I'm 100 episodes in at this point. I'm nowhere near done. I barely even jumped into the Ultra franchise, which I've only done the original series, Ultra Q. I've talked about that I'm going to do, I'm going to jump into, like, some Super Sentai stuff. And not just the Super Sentai stuff, but talking about the Americanized version of it as well that everyone knows as Power Rangers. Like, talking about that. And, you know, I've got some things that I want to do on the YouTube channel. I've recently started getting, like, bad
like B studio films and watching them and doing reviews on them. And
oh, we got to get in on that. The
first one I did was Ape versus Monster. What do you think that's a ripoff
of? Wow.
Star Is Born.
That came out, it came out the same year as another big so-and-so versus so-and-so movie and all of that. But I've gotten some other ones. China is actually starting to really shell out some I wouldn't necessarily say kaiju films, but they're like giant monster films, like giant snakes or, you know, something like that.
Look into, like, Roger Corman films as well.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to look, because whenever I did Ape versus Monster, like, it was a chore to sit through. It was... or, you know, it had Eric Roberts stars in it. He's really...
At least that!
He's really fallen. You know, like, I remember when Eric Roberts used to be, you know, in some pretty...
Best of the best.
Yeah, like some A-list movies and all
He's been in over 600 movies at this point.
Yeah,
man.
And that.
He's scraping the bottom of the barrel of what he can do.
Well, you know, if he's in Ape versus Monster that was done by the Asylum, absolutely, he's at the bottom of the barrel. Like, and that's no disrespect towards Eric Roberts. I'm a big fan of his.
Same.
But, yeah, so China is starting to put out some pretty crappy monster movies that I've already bought some of. The Asylum, not only did they do Ape vs. Monster, which is obviously a ripoff of Godzilla vs. Kong, very conveniently around the same time as another film that came out, they released one called Planet Dune.
Oh, yeah.
That just so happens to have a giant, like, worm with lots of teeth on the cover and all of that kind of stuff. Gee, I wonder what this film's trying to capitalize on, you know? Like... So yeah, I'm gonna cover that, and I've got a lot more to do. I'm wanting to jump into some more some anime stuff, talking about like big mech, like Robotech, Gundam, and all that kind of stuff.
Oh,
because
yeah.
In my opinion, a lot of times big mech goes hand in hand with kaiju.
Oh yeah. Sure,
like so.
A good combination of the two, a specific rim. That's
yeah,
like
Voltron. I'm gonna be doing Voltron
with the
eventually.
Robeast. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I've still got a way to go. Like I'm nowhere near.
Fantastic.
You know, close to being
I'm
done.
I'm glad you were able to have us on. I'm glad I was able to be here for this one.
Yeah, I'm glad both of you were able to be here for this one, because there for a while it was looking like you, at least, probably was not going to be available because of your trip.
Yeah, my wife got tickets to a concert in New Orleans. She bought them back around Halloween, somewhere in that area.
Chris likes boy bands.
I do not like boy bands. And then completely and repeatedly forgot to tell me to take the day off of work for it. So we ended up leaving at like noon on Friday to drive to New Orleans. It took like 3.5, almost 4 hours because traffic is horrible. And I told you, Cal, that I was going to be coming back. I said, we're going to be leaving Sunday morning. I messaged you around 9:30 saying, hey, we are officially leaving New Orleans. And I got back in about 2.5 hours, which is pretty good time. So
for those of you that don't live in Louisiana, a general like average time to get from Alexandria to New Orleans is right at about 4 hours, give or take.
Yeah.
So the fact that he was able to make it, yeah, he was breaking some laws trying to get back. So.
I think I averaged, even in the cities where the speed limit was 45, I don't think I dropped below 55 a single time.
It's like Matt McConaughey said, I think we're going to lawbreak.
It also helped that I had no traffic, so going 85 for the majority of the way home, I was able to make it pretty well.
But yeah, so I think after I'm done with Harryhausen month and all of that, I'm going to do a more like popular entry into like a traditional kaiju film, just because it will have been over a month since I've done a traditional kaiju film only dealing with Ray Harryhausen stuff. I haven't decided which one I'm going to do yet. But after that, I'll probably do 2 or 3 traditional kaiju films, and then I'll probably do a review of one of the bad monster movies that I've got. Which I own them, you know, on DVD. They're over there. And so I can invite you guys over and, yeah, we can watch this trash and, you know, just rip it and all of that kind of stuff. And I'm looking at ways to where, like, I can record, like, I might do it as well on a podcast to where it's doubled up, but I'm looking at ways to where I can record the movie that's altered just slightly so that I can get out of like copyright infringement and all that kind of stuff, but having like our audio attached to it. to where like people
like MST3K or
pretty much like yeah, someone to where like they can just go watch, you know, click on the movie or whatever, and the whole time they're just listening to the three of us just rip this thing a new one.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, so I'm looking at ways to be able to do that. So yeah, guys, thanks again for 100 episodes. Go like me on all of my social medias. On Facebook, I'm Kaiju Carnage, a Godzilla / King Kong podcast. I've also got a Godzilla Ultima fan page from Singular Point. And then on Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok, I'm just simply Cal the Kaiju Guy. So again, Chris, Ian, thank you all for being on the show.
Thank you for having us.
My pleasure.
And we will catch y'all on the next episode, which will be on Jason and the Argonauts, continuing Ray Harryhausen month. And then I've only got two more films to do, Jason and the Argonauts, and then the following Saturday will be Harryhausen's last film that he did, Clash of the Titans. So, all righty, guys, we'll catch you all then. Thanks again for 100 episodes. Congratulations, Robert, on winning. Just get with me, shoot me a message for your address and all that so I can mail you the gift card, and then just let me know whatever movie it is you're wanting me to do. So, alrighty, guys, we'll catch y'all next time. This is Cal the Kaiju Guy signing out.